Hello, today is Wednesday, February 18th, 2026. Following is a 60-minute reading coming to you from the Talking Information Center, featuring selections from the latest edition of Time Magazine. My name is Fred. Back to the moon. The celebrated Earthrise picture, okay, you can't see that, my apologies, picture of the moon. Back to the moon. Artemis II is poised for the first lunar mission since 1972, with much more to come. This piece is by Jeffrey Kluger. Humanity has changed an awful lot in the past 58 years. The moon? Not so much. It was in 1968 that astronauts first drew near the moon. And it was early this year, and it will be early this year if all goes as planned, that a crew will return, representing a species with gadgets and abilities, and yes, problems that didn't exist that half century plus ago. Back then, the darkest concern was that to visit the moon would be to ruin the moon. That was the way Susan Borman put it to Chris Kraft, NASA's then Director of Flight Operations, a few months before the December 21 launch of Apollo 8. Borman was married to Frank Borman, the commander of the mission, who would lead a crew that for the first time would leave Earth orbit and venture moonward. Apollo 8 had two possible mission profiles, the safer one and the scarier one. The safer one involved whipping once around the moon's far side and then relying on lunar gravity to slingshot the spacecraft back to Earth. The scary one involved reaching the moon and using Apollo 8's howitzer of a main engine to slow the ship down and settle into lunar orbit, circling the moon 10 times before coming home. The problem with the scary mission was the coming home part. If the main engine fired once to place the crew into orbit, but failed to fire a second time to blast them out, the ship would become a permanent satellite. In a permanent sarcophagus, orbiting around and around and around the lunar equator, long after the oxygen fuel cells that kept the crew alive ran out. So Susan, who had no interest in being widowed by the moon, buttonholed Kraft in his office. Quote, "If they get stuck," she said, "you'll ruin the moon for everyone. No one will be able to look at it again without thinking about those three dead men." Kraft was unmoved. He ordered up the orbital mission, and with that, the great plates of history shifted. On Christmas Eve, the crew reached lunar orbit, turned on their TV camera, and beamed back images of the ancient ruined lunar surface to a television audience of more than 1 billion people, or one-third of the human population. The three men, Borman, Jim Lovell, and Bill Anders, conducted a 27-minute cosmic travelogue and, at the end, on that cold, holy night, took turns reading from the Book of Genesis. When they were done, Borman concluded the show. And from the crew of Apollo 8, he said, "We close with good luck, good night, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you on the good earth." That Christmas wish served as a coda and a redemption for a blood-soaked year that saw assassinations in the U.S., Soviet tanks in Prague, a North Vietnamese offensive on the holiday of Tet, riots at the Democratic Convention in Chicago, and more. Borman, Lovell, and Anders received unaccounted cards, letters, and telegrams when they returned. But the one that moved them most, from a woman whose name is now forgotten, read simply, "Thank you. You saved 1968. The still young year of 2026 could be similarly redeemed. As soon as February 6th, the crew of Artemis II is set to head moonward, It will certainly not spell the first human expedition to the moon, but it will be the first since 1972, when the crew Apollo 17 came home. The Apollo moon program was canceled, and the translunar trail went dark. History recalls the names of Borman, Lovell, and Anders, of Apollo 11's Neil Armstrong, Michael Collins, and Buzz Aldrin, of Apollo 13's Lovell, Jack Swigart, and Fred Hayes. It may soon recall as well Artemis II's Reid Wiseman, Victor Glover, Christina Koch, and Jeremy Hansen. Asked if he feels the weight of history as the flight draws near, Wiseman, who will follow in the footsteps of Borman, Armstrong, and Lovell as commander of the mission, at first jokes, quote, "Until about 30 seconds ago, I didn't," he says, "but seriously, I really don't think any of us have thought about that aspect of the mission. I really think we are taking the next right step in a sustained lunar presence. The important thing about being first is that there's a second, third, fourth, and more. For a mission that carries so much hope, Artemis II will fly a relatively simple trajectory. After launch, it will make two long, high, looping orbits around the Earth before pointing toward the moon, firing its engine and pulling itself away from the grip of earthly gravity. It will follow the safe profile craft long ago rejected, flying around the far side of the moon and coming home without a lunar orbit to end a 10-day mission. But those 10 days will serve as a critical test for NASA's giant space launch system, known as SLS, Moon Rocket, and the Orion spacecraft, preparatory to lunar landings by Artemis 3, 4, and 5, and beyond. Artemis 2 will take the crew farther from Earth than any human beings have ever traveled before. The crippled Apollo 13 spacecraft flew a similar circumlunar route, reaching 158 miles beyond the far side of the moon at its most remote remove. For 55 years, that crew held the distance record, but Artemis 2 will smash it when the spacecraft travels a whopping 4,700 miles beyond the lunar backside. From that distance, the crew will be able to take dramatic photographs of the sphere of the Earth and the sphere of the moon in the same frame. I very intentionally keep myself from thinking about what seeing the far side will be like, says Wiseman, because no matter what your expectation is, the reality will be different. Not only will Artemis II be the first mission to reach the moon in more than half a century, it will also represent a significant demographic and cultural shift. Koch will be the first woman to go to the moon, Glover the first person of color, and Hansen, a Canadian, the first non-American. More than a decade ago, NASA decided that equity and inclusion would be part of its core values, says Glover. Those decisions have led us to having an astronaut office that looks very much like America. You could reach in and grab any four people, and they would look like this crew. We have a lot of global problems, says Hansen, and those global problems require global solutions. This, including a Canadian on Artemis II, is an amazing example of what we can do together. The U.S. and Canada are not the only countries that have stakes in Artemis. In 2020, NASA and the U.S. State Department established the Artemis Accords, a pact that has now been signed by 60 countries, binding member states to the peaceful exploration of space. Even as geopolitical alliances have been strained, the accords still stand, at least for now. Signatories are also invited to contribute modules, money, and other resources, including astronauts, to the Artemis program, with a long-term goal of establishing a permanent base near the South Lunar Pole, where deposits of ice can serve as an abundant source of water, rocket fuel, and breathable oxygen for astronaut residents. The widely accepted headcount of people who were in some who were in some way involved in getting Apollo astronauts to the moon is 400,000, nearly all of them American. A similar standing army, this time international, is being mustered for Artemis. The other day I was thinking about when we arrive at the moon, says Koch, and the only way I can accept that my name is in that grouping is that we're part of a team, people who are doing the hard work. The four members of the Artemis II crew will get to the moon together at the same moment in the same spacecraft, but they will have arrived there by different routes. Glover's path began in 1986 when he was 10 years old and he and his mother were waiting for a bus in Los Angeles. It was too cold for L.A. even in the winter and certainly too cold for the thin jacket he was wearing, but his mother, who was raising him alone and working multiple jobs to keep the lights on and the rent paid, could not afford the luxury of a proper winter coat for her son in what was usually a balmy town. So he stood at the top as the wind cut through his jacket, watching enviously as cars after car drove by, all of them looking warm, all of them looking cozy, all of them carrying lucky people who weren't standing in the cold, waiting for a bus that would never come. And he had a thought. When I get out of having to live this way, he resolved, I will never do it again. I will never go back. His first step toward getting out involved studying hard. He excelled in his elementary and middle school years. As a high school student, he was intrigued by the sciences and enrolled in an AP biology class 2 years in a row, just because he loved it. He was brilliant, recalls his teacher, Robin Akeda. He was insatiable, curious, and wide-eyed. He was super happy, too. I never had anybody sign up for a course voluntarily a second time. When it came time for college, biology fell away and Glover studied engineering at California Polytech State University. After he graduated, he entered the Navy and trained to be an aviator, amassing more than 400 takeoffs and landings from the deck of the USS John F. Kennedy. But military life can exact a high price, and for Glover, the constant deployments and assignments meant time away from his wife and four daughters. In 2012, he thus made a career pivot. Two pivots, actually. He applied for a Naval Legislative Fellowship position, seeking a year-long job on Capitol Hill, and at the same time sent his resume to the NASA astronaut program. The fellowship came through straight away, and Glover was assigned to the office of Senator John McCain. Glover would not, however, serve his full one-year rotation. 9 months in, he was walking through the rotunda of the Russell Senate office building when he noticed a missed call on his cell phone from NASA. I called them back, and I was on hold for like half of eternity, Glover says. Finally, Janet Gavandi, a former astronaut and the chair of the Astronaut Selection Committee, came on the line and welcomed him to the astronaut team. The next morning, Glover says she sent me an email saying it was not a dream. Glover, now 49, has been in space one time since then, spending 168 days aboard the International Space Station, ISS, from November 2020 to May 2021. Koch, age 46, made her way to NASA via the South Pole. When she was a child, her dual fascinations were Antarctica and space, and the walls of her bedroom were covered with posters and maps of both. If anyone within a country mile said the word Antarctica, I was all over it, asking, how can I get there? When can I go? She says. Born in Grand Rapids, Michigan, she relocated to North Carolina State University to study electrical engineering and physics. In 2002, with those twin degrees in her pocket, she went to work for NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, assigned to a team designing spacecraft instruments. But after 2 years there, Koch gave in to her Antarctica itch, applying to become a research associate in the United States Antarctica program. She spent the better part of 3 years in Antarctica, including a year-long stay at the Amundsen Scott South Pole Station. Even with a handful of other researchers to keep her company, the isolation was challenging, the work demanding, and the elements absolutely punishing. During one especially frigid spell, the temperature outside the team's small habitat fell to minus 111 degrees Fahrenheit. In early 2013, having ticked her Antarctica box, Koch turned back to her other passion and applied for admission to NASA's astronaut class. The interview process was long. Finally, in June, she got a call from Cavandi. "We're calling to tell you to join our team," Cavandi said. "We want you to come to Houston." That call led to a whopping 328-day stay aboard the ISS from March 2019 to February 2020, a record that still stands for longest single spaceflight by a woman. During the course of that station rotation, Koch also participated in the first all-woman spacewalk, along with astronaut Jessica Meyer. The event was a milestone that generated much buzz back home on Earth. Then House Speaker Nancy Pelosi took to what was then known as Twitter, applauding Koch and Meyer for leaving their mark on history. Hansen, age 49, the Canadian, has yet to make that mark. The only rookie in the Artemis II group, he comes to space via a farm in Elsa Craig, Ontario, where he lived as a child, going to school during the day and helping with chores in his off hours. Much of that time, his mind was on flying. From an early age, he knew he wanted to become a pilot and join the military. When he was 12, his father helped him enroll in the Royal Canadian Air Cadet Squadron, a youth leadership group that trains kids ages 12 to 18 to fly while they go to school. It promises to get them behind the stick of a glider in their first year in the Corps. "It has a loose military affiliation," Hansen says. "You wear a uniform, you polish your boots, you drill, and you do get to go flying." Hansen had his glider license by age 16 and his private pilot's license the next year. Upon graduation from high school, he enrolled in the Royal Military College St. Jean, where he ultimately earned a master's degree in physics. He joined the Royal Canadian Air Force and was eventually assigned to the North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD, patrolling the skies over the Arctic. In 2008, the Canadian Space Agency opened its book for its astronaut team. Hansen applied and in the next year got the nod. He spent the past 17 years training for a mission, any mission. And at last, on April 3rd, 2023, he got the call that he had been tapped for the moon. "Excuse me. He came home in a celebratory, excited mood," recalls Hansen's wife, Catherine. "He said, 'It's happening. It's official. All that we'd hoped for is coming true.'" Wiseman, age 50, the mission commander, earned his path to the peaceable moon in part by serving war-torn Earth. It's a twister. A graduate of Rensselaer Polytech Institute in Johns Hopkins University, where he earned first a bachelor's degree and then a master's, both in systems engineering, he was commissioned as a naval aviator in 1997 through Rensselaer's Reserve Officers Training Corps program. He became a flyer at a dangerous time, serving before and after the September 11th attacks and throughout long stretches of the war in Iraq, completing 5 deployments. The combat missions he flew sit a bit uneasily with him today. "I shouldn't say I didn't like it," he says, "but I don't ever need to do that again. I didn't like it for the people on the ground. They didn't like it for us in the air. I definitely scared the shite out of myself sometimes. In 2008, Wiseman changed directions along with 3,500 other hopeful applicants. He submitted his name for selection as a member of NASA's 20th class of new astronauts. The next year, nine of them, Wiseman included, was selected. He's since flown 165-day space. He's flown a 165-day space station rotation in 2014, and from 2022 to 2020, and from 2020 to 2022, he served as head of the NASA astronaut office. There was never a launch where I didn't think I was on the verge of a heart attack, because you know the careers. You know the careers you've assigned to that mission, he says. You're thinking about their successes, their family, how they are doing. I spent a lot of time agonizing over every little thing. Come February, when the engines light on the SLS rocket, the people on the ground will be feeling that for Wiseman and his crew. Artemis II's journey to the moon will by no means follow on as the crow flies trajectory. The mission will begin when the sixth first stage engines of the SLS moon rocket ignite, four liquid-fueled and two strap-on solid-fuel rockets. Since 1968, the most powerful rocket ever to lift humans has been the Apollo program Saturn V, which put out a literally ground-shaking 7.5 pounds of thrust. The SLS produces a staggering 8 million pounds of thrust. On its upward climb, the SLS will quickly exhaust the fuel in all six of its first stage engines, and they will be jettisoned, leaving only the rocket's upper stage in the Orion spacecraft to reach orbit. That orbit will be a lopsided one with a low point or perigee of 105 miles and a high point of apogee of 1,400, far higher than the 250-mile altitude at which the ISS flies. After one 90-minute sprint around the Earth, the still-attached upper stage engine will fire, raising the orbit to a perigee of 1,500 miles and apogee of 46,000 miles, an altitude that takes the spacecraft about a fifth of the way to the moon. At that speed and that altitude, the ship needs a relatively small push to break free of Earth orbit and head moonward, a maneuver called translunar injection, TLI. That critical step will occur after one more orbit around the Earth, when Orion jettisons the upper stage and relies on its own smaller service module engine to give it the kick it needs to soar out to the moon. It will take about 4 days for the ship to cross the total 244,000-mile void between Earth and the moon. The crew's closest approach to the moon's surface will be about 4,000 miles above the lunar peaks, increasing to its record-breaking distance of 4,700 miles on the far side before lunar gravity slingshots the ship back to Earth on another 4-day journey. The final leg of the trip, re-entry into Earth's atmosphere, will take some fancy flying. Spacecraft re-entering from Earth orbit tap the brakes of their retro rockets to reduce their 17,500-mile-per-hour speed, causing them to fall slowly from the sky and ease their way into the atmosphere. The Artemis II will instead slam into the atmosphere at a speed of 25,000 miles per hour. Both styles of re-entry are fiery as an Earth-orbiting spacecraft descends. Temperatures of up to 3,500 degrees Fahrenheit bloom across the heat shield at the bottom of the capsule. The fast-moving Orion spacecraft will have to endure a blistering 5,000 degree Fahrenheit, half as hot as the surface of the sun. To make that re-entry survivable, Orion will not descend on a relatively straight trajectory the way an orbital ship does, but it will instead fly a so-called skip entry path, entering the atmosphere, climbing back into space, and then re-entering, bleeding off heat and gravitational forces along the way. That roller coaster ride was perfected on Apollo 8 and was used successfully on each of the other eight lunar missions that followed. Still, that does not mean the exercise won't be hair-raising for the crew of Artemis II. Asked about the larger meaning of the 10-day mission, Glover focuses instead on the last minutes of the last day. "Let's go to splashdown successfully," he says. "Then maybe we can revisit the question." It won't be long after splashdown that another pressing question will be on everyone's minds. What comes next? Artemis II is what space planners call an engineering mission, one intended less to explore than to test all of the spacecraft's onboard systems, propulsions, navigation, life support, computer, guidance, communications, and more. It will also test the mettle of the crew in space, the launch team in Florida, and the mission controllers in Houston. There are a lot of cobwebs for NASA to shake off after a 54-year hiatus between lunar missions. Officially, the next mission, Artemis III, will get the nod to land on the moon. Officially, too, that will happen by 2028, but few people believe that goal is achievable. The target date has slipped repeatedly from 2024 to 2025, then September 2026, then mid-2027. At the moment, the biggest problem concerns the lunar landing craft, which inconveniently does not exist. Okay. Like the Apollo crews, Artemis astronauts will use two vehicles to execute a lunar landing, a mothership to orbit the moon and re-enter Earth's atmosphere, and a lander to take two of the four astronauts down from orbit to the lunar surface. In 2021, NASA awarded Elon Musk's SpaceX the contract to build the lander and cut the company a $2.89 billion check to get the work done. In the Apollo days, the lander and the mother ship were launched on the same rocket. Today's larger, more capable lander will be launched separately on a different rocket from the SLS and dock with Orion in space. The rocket SpaceX proposes using is its massive Starship, with the upper stage of the vehicle configured as the lunar lander. From the beginning, it was an improbable choice. The Apollo lunar module stood 23 feet tall, weighed just 32,500 pounds, flyweight as spacecraft go, and had a splayed four-legged stance that gave it a low, sure-footed center of gravity. The Starship lander, by contrast, is a silvery silo, weighing 200,000 pounds and standing 165 feet tall, requiring an onboard elevator rather than a ladder to get the astronauts down to the ground. Once it's launched, it won't fly straight to the moon, but rather will loiter in Earth orbit while up to 20 fuel tanks, are launched to gas it before it leaves. That's a lot of machine for an already complicated job, and it hasn't helped that Starship rockets have repeatedly exploded or otherwise failed on multiple tests over the past 3 years, pushing lander development far beyond schedule. The delay has been especially concerning to lawmakers and space planners in the face of China's expressed goal of landing astronauts on the moon by 2030. Kicking off a 21st century reprise of the old U.S.-Soviet space race, the Starship architecture is extraordinarily complex. Former Administrator Jim Bridenstine said during Senate testimony in September 2025. It quite frankly doesn't make a lot of sense if you're trying to go first to the moon, this time to beat China. It quite frankly doesn't make a lot of sense if you're trying to go first to the moon, this time to beat China. By last October, then-acting NASA Administrator Sean Duffy had seen enough. "I'm going to open up the contract," he said in an appearance on CNBC. "I'm going to let other space companies compete with SpaceX. We're going to push this forward and win the second space race against the Chinese." Musk responded colorfully, "Sean Dummy is trying to kill NASA," he posted on X. "The person responsible for America's space program can't have a two-digit IQ." But SpaceX quickly fell in line. In November, the company posted a lengthy Artemis update on its website describing the R&D milestones it has already achieved on the way to completing its Starship lander and offering reassurance that work on the project was indeed proceeding apace. At the same time, Blue Origin, the space company owned by Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, submitted a proposal to NASA that included plans for its Blue Moon Mark I lander, a vehicle that is supposed to have an uncrewed test flight to the moon atop Blue Origin's New Glenn rocket sometime this year. Also in the hunt is Lockheed Martin, the prime contractor for the Orion spacecraft, which is proposing an accelerated plan to build a lunar lander cobbled together from hardware already in existence. "We call it design for inventory," Rob Chambers, Lockheed's senior director for human spaceflight strategy, told Time in October. "We're sitting down with industry partners and saying not, what part can I order out of your catalog, but what serial number exists today, even if it's on another spacecraft?" All of that, however, is for later. For now, most of the focus is on Artemis II. A return to the lunar neighborhood will not only represent a significant, if perhaps temporary, edge in any space race that does exist with China, but also offer a kind of poetic public uplift that, since the early 1960s, spaceflight has uniquely been able to provide. Not every mission, of course, touches the collective soul, but some do. John Glenn's three orbits of Earth in 1962, Apollo 8's Christmas Eve lyricism, Apollo 11's lunar landing, Apollo 13's His Breath Rescue, all were less American experiences than global dramas, global triumphs, or global joys. In 2019, Collins, the commander module pilot for Apollo 11, whose station kept aboard the orbiting mothership while Armstrong and Aldrin flew down to the surface and pressed the first boot prints onto the moon, spoke to Time about the international reaction he experienced when the crew toured the world after their return. "I thought that when we went someplace, they'd say, 'Well, congratulations, you Americans finally did it,'" Collins recalled. "And instead of that, unanimously, the reaction was, 'We did it. We humans finally left this planet and went past escape velocity.'" Of the 24 lunar astronauts who did the leaving from 1968 to 1972, only five, all in their 90s, remain. With Artemis II, the lunar ledger will at last be reopened and four more names inscribed. A fine and fit crew who will be sent into a cosmic deep as emissaries of the 8.3 billion of us who will remain forever earthbound. Apollo 8 saved 1968. Artemis 2 may work similar magic today. Okay, totally switching gears. Let's go to the Time Off section of Time Magazine. Domestic Disturbance by Judy Berman, actually. How a soapy strain of thriller became the defining metaphor of our time. A woman seems to have the perfect life. She looks like Robin Wright or Megan Fahey, or remarkably often Nicole Kidman. Her career, if she has one, is created of philanthropic. Her blue-blooded husband is a silver fox, Hugh Grant, or in Adonis, Alexander Skarsgård. They have a cute kid or two, and whether they reside in a chic suburb, a beachfront mansion, or a city loft, their kitchen is sure to have the most majestic island you've ever seen. Then comes the crisis. The woman is assaulted. The husband is cheating. A child disappears. A suspicious stranger arrives. Somebody gets murdered. That perfect life becomes a nightmare or is revealed to have been one all along. These are the contours of the contemporary domestic thriller, a niche that has come to dominate every form of narrative entertainment by, for, and about women. Again, these are the contours of the contemporary domestic thriller, a niche that has come to dominate every form of narrative entertainment by, for, and about women. At first, its proliferation seemed a typical case of Hollywood copycatting. Big Little Lies becomes a smash, wins Emmys, begins flimsy imitations that lots of people watch anyway. But at this point, the trend's persistence suggests a more profound connection between these stories and their audience. Domestic thrillers have always existed because women's fears of patriarchal violence and control, particularly in the supposed sanctuary of the home, Spring Eternal. Certainly, American life has given us many new causes for worry. Yet the domestic thriller is no longer just a fever dream of gender anxiety. These are stories of an enemy infiltrating intimate spaces. A husband, a neighbor, a nanny, people who are supposed to be safe but are actually dangerous. Communities fractured along invisible rifts. These literal houses divided against themselves have broad resonance in a paranoid society in the throes of what the journalist Jeff Charlotte calls a slow civil war. Just as slowly, the domestic thriller has become the defining metaphor of our time. A posh murder mystery with a wrinkle. We don't know who the victim is. HBO's Big Little Lies, based on Leanne Moriarty's novel, set the template for the current generation of domestic thrillers. Lies lured viewers with its starry cast, rich bitch moms in lush coastal setting, then surprised us by spinning scandal into an astute study of how abuse compounds across generations. Premiering weeks after Trump took office in 2007, it was more optimistic in its feminism than another new series that overtly confronted right-wing misogyny, The Handmaid's Tale, that is. Lies didn't invent the domestic thriller. The term describes psychological thrillers that are set in the home or neighborhood, interrogate familial or community relationships, and usually center on female characters. Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre, with its haunted female narrator in Mad Woman in the Attic, retroactively fits this brief. Some have argued that the domestic thriller can be traced back to media, M-E-D-E-A. The format flourished in the middle of the 20th century in books by Daphne du Maurier and movies like Gaslight, mirroring the psyches of women who'd been empowered to run the home front during World War II, then married into suburban cages. That predominantly white, middle-class, feminine mystique cohort, whose frustrations would fuel the 70s feminist revolution fixated on gender. When Gillian Flynn's 2012 novel, Gone Girl, became a phenomenon two generations later, it illustrated the subtler power imbalances that persisted within heterosexual relationships, a rant by its psycho wife character about how women contort themselves into perfect cool girls in order to be deemed lovable by men went viral because Reed is related. 14 years later, the domestic thriller reigns supreme. It has gone highbrow in layered series, like an adaptation of Flynn's Sharp Objects in Roma auteur Alfonso Cuarón's stylish Disclaimer. It's hit new yet popular lows in Netflix's nonsensical Behind Her Eyes, in the clumsily written domestic thriller meets romance novel or novels of Colleen Hoover, whose work will have fueled four films from 2024 to 2026. Roughly 3% of print adult fiction books sold in the U.S. last year were by the housemaid author Freda McFadden. Released in December, the housemaid film has earned more than $200 million and counting, making it arguably 2025's biggest movie aimed at adult women. We're even seeing work that filters gendered horrors through male eyes. What is adolescence? A portrait of a family destroyed by the son's murder of a girl in Netflix's second most watched series of all time, if not a domestic thriller. Big Little Lies made wealth disparity a crucial ingredient of the new domestic thriller. Like Jane Eyre, a governess who fell for her affluent employer, Shailene Woodley's character, a young single mother, is a broke outsider in an exclusive community. Yet instead of marrying a local bigwig, she recognizes one of them as her son's rapist father, catalyzing his demise. Storylines like this, in our age of escalated eat-the-rich sentiment, allow viewers to vicariously enjoy beautiful homes and high-maintenance bodies while also fantasizing about or for more comfortable audiences, safely exploring fears of class warfare. This scenario, a woman with no money destabilizes a family of means, has become a blueprint. Last year's relentlessly twisty The Girlfriend on Prime Video cast Olivia Cooke as a slightly unhinged working-class striver at odds with her upper-class boyfriend's even more deranged mother, played by Wright. In Peacock's All Her Fault, a nanny from a rough background, Sophia Lillis, disappears with her rich employer's little boy, while she and his working mom, Sarah Snook, are initially seen as culprits. The boy's selfish father, Jake Lacy, who played similar roles in Apples Never Fall and The White Lotus, turns out to be the guiltiest party of all. These middling domestic thrillers play on simplistic beliefs and fears. Rich people are bad, male entitlement is out of control, moms can't win, aging is scary, losing a child is scarier. Yet they also capture ambient anxieties about the boundaries of community, anxieties interrogated with more purpose and style in the best domestic thrillers. Sharp Objects uses a murder mystery to excavate the rot at the core of a Missouri town whose mythology glorifies the Confederacy. As if cursed since the Civil War, residents mistake their homegrown villains for heroes. The paranoia that governs American life echoes the paranoid logic of the domestic thriller. We wheel carts through markets wondering which of the two-faced neighbors who politely greet us will vote in a way that hurts or disgusts us. We pray that law enforcement sent to our cities will do its ostensible job of making us safer, not turn on us. We are always negotiating. Who is one of us? Who means us or our kids harm? Is it the outsiders clamoring for a piece of what we've earned, or the insiders hoarding advantages? Maybe it's no coincidence that from Gone Girl to The Girlfriend, the contemporary domestic thriller so often hinges on dramatic shifts in point of view. In a society that no longer agrees on fundamental truths, everything is a matter of perspective. It might seem as if the domestic thriller has peaked, but another huge year lies ahead for wealthy white women in peril. As A Housemaid sequel enters production and we await two Hoover movies, the author's new thriller, Woman Down, is among the first of dozens to come in the niche in 2026. On TV, we'll see Elizabeth Moss and Kerry Washington, a little Fires Everywhere star who's been one of the genre's few non-white leads, as friends torn apart by crime in Apple's Imperfect Woman. Kaylee Cuoco as a vacationer whose boyfriend disappears and vanished on MGM Plus. And season two of The Last Thing He Told Me, among many others. A third season of Lies is in the works. The trend is evolving, though. Many of the most enjoyable recent domestic thrillers betray some self-awareness about the absurdity of the tropes they recycle. Paul Feig, who directed the dark preschool parent crime comedy A Simple Favor and its 2025 sequel, brought the same archness to his Housemaid movie. Fans at my screening howled as ex-con maid Sydney Sweeney and desperate housewife Amanda Seyfried waged their hysterical suburban war. You don't have to dig deep to spot the irreverence in Netflix breakout The Hunting Wives. A blue state transplant, Brittany Snow, is absorbed into a clique of sexy, sapphic, potentially murderous right-wing society women in Texas. Like straight-faced domestic thrillers, both stories play on the opposition of outsiders and insiders in elite worlds. Both savor catfights but frame men as dogs. Yet like much of what has transpired during the second Trump presidency, they express a sense of history repeating itself. First as tragedy, then as farce, but also still tragedy. A pessimistic read on this shift towards self-mockery would be that it's just an important admission that the bad, enemy-within vibes are here to stay, a way of laughing because our only other option is to cry. But I'd prefer to imagine these stories as seeds of subversion, poking fun at misogyny, privilege, and partisan polarization is an activism, yet it may be an early step in the long process of wrestling our narrative from the grip of despair. In the fight against fear, a weapon too often underestimated is joy. Okay, I think we have time for a movie review here. Young mothers face the world with fear and tenderness. The Belgian filmmaker duo Jean-Pierre and Luc Dardenne have been making observant, low-key films for so long now that it's easy to take them for granted. Their trademark is simple. They take an interest in anyone society may have forgotten, people who struggle harder than most to get through the week, yet often show it less. Marion Cotillard's laid-off factory worker in 2 days, one night, the African immigrants of Tori and Lokita, striving to build a life in a world that doesn't want them, the 11-year-old boy and the kid with a bike, abandoned by his father. The Dardennes don't specialize in complex plots. They're interested in quotidian survival. The Dardennes movies have a gentle uniformity, which is why they often slip through the cracks among flashier pictures vying for our attention. But Young Mothers is among their best. So emphatically understated that its full power may not hit you until hours later. The picture is set, like many of their films, in Liège, Belgium. It follows four very young women who are either pregnant or have just given birth, all living in a shelter where their target, rather, they're living in a shelter where they're taught to care for their infants before they're recirculated back into the world. Arianne, played by Juniana Hallofoken, born into an impoverished family, wants to place her tiny daughter Lily with adoptive parents, though her mother tries to force her to keep the child. Perla, played by Lucy Laurel, Perla, a winsome teenager with a ballerina topknot, desperately wants to form a family with her baby's father. A delinquent kid with no interest in her or their child, Julie Elsa Eubin, is a recovering drug addict who adores her new baby and has big plans to marry her supportive boyfriend, though she's riddled with anxiety about backsliding into addiction. And Jessica, played by Babette Verbeek, perhaps the most vulnerable of all, yearns to meet the birth mother who gave her up. She fears she's stuck in a cycle that will prevent her from bonding with her child. A fifth young woman, Nema, played by Samia Hilmi, is a role model for all of them. She's leaving the shelter to go back to school. Young Mother is one of those movies that manages to feel both spare. Let's do that again. Young Mothers is one of those movies that manage to feel both spare and detailed at once. What strikes you is how seemingly modest these young women's goals are. All of them, even Julie, with her solid partner, who has the vibe of a sweet Belgian, will have to find someone, sort of work as they care for their babies. Sometimes that feels like more than they can manage, given that they're also dealing with outside forces beyond their control. Their own bossy, unhelpful, or absentee mothers, negligent partners, aggressive drug dealers with a vested interest in their former clients. You can see why even learning to mix up a bottle of baby formula can feel like a huge responsibility. To play these characters, the Dardennes have cast young women who, though all of them have acted before in some capacity, still have a quietly moving guilelessness. These performances are forthright, unvarnished. What hits you immediately is how impossibly young these characters are. Young Mothers is fiction, but it has the feel of a documentary. You recognize that these women's feelings and their fears are certainly playing out somewhere in your own city or town, probably in your own neighborhood. When Arianne meets her baby's adoptive parents, she asks them tentatively if either plays an instrument. She's visibly relieved to learn that the potential young father plays the saxophone. Then she begs these eager prospective parents to make sure her daughter has music in her life. What a strange, simple, yet wholly believable thing. Arianne, of course, wants her daughter to have loving parents, enough to eat, a chance to succeed. And still, music is what she's thinking of as she's about to hand Lily to a new family forever. It's an example of what the Dardennes do so well. Looking at the texture of everyday lives and finding the threads of grace running beneath. Okay, a little more time. Let's see if we can fit in another. Here's an essay. Heated Rivalry depicts autism with a familiar kind of love. The majority of autistic-coded characters in film and television have long looked, moved, and sounded a certain way. Think Dustin Hoffman's Raymond in Rain Man, Jim Parsons' Sheldon in The Big Bang Theory, Freddie Highmore's Sean in The Good Doctor. They stand with the same awkward posture. They make the same gestures and twitches. They have an arrhythmic cadence that slips into a hyperverbal torrent during moments of stress or excitement. These portrayals aren't entirely wrong, but there's so much more to the autistic experience than one collection of external tells. Shane Hollander, played by Hudson Williams in Heated Rivalry, the smash hit Canadian queer hockey romance, diverges from this autistic archetype into a number of refreshing ways. He has a flat effect with a voice that barely breaks out of a small range of notes and a face that's largely unreadable unless you're watching carefully. He's Asian at a time when most autistic representation is still overwhelmingly white. The lack of explicit discussion of autism in his story makes sense for his character. Plenty of people who thrive in a field related to their special interest don't realize that they're autistic until later in life, if at all. You might also notice the gears spinning as he arrives to process unexpected situations and conversations, or the tension he carries, how he's never quite sure what he's supposed to be doing with himself off the ice, and how it eases when he's with someone who truly gets him. Now, given the shortness of time, I'm going to shoot to the end here. Still, the majority of autistic characters have been the result of outsiders observing external behaviors in a population that they consider alien. Hoffman studied autistic savants in order to mimic their mannerisms for Rain Man, which in turn influenced future performers. Some productions, like Atypical, turned into non-autistic experts on autism for their insights. Autistic people were studied with little regard for who we are or what might be happening beneath the surface and turned into caricatures that were celebrated as bold artistic statements. Art by the people who know and love autistic people is better than all of that, though it isn't a substitute for art by autistic people. Still, when I think about what kind of radical acceptance I want to see as an autistic person, characters like Shane and his Genesis are absolutely part of that picture. When autistic people are valued and welcomed as we are, we will rub off on the creative people around us, and pieces of us all will find their way into their work, as complex and whole parts of the world worth exploring and celebrating. And there you have it. We're going to wrap it up here on this 18th day of the second month in the year 2026. It's been a pleasure reading to you from the Talking Information Center. I hope you've enjoyed listening. And better still, I hope you have a wonderful day. Please do take care. My name is Fred.